Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome in to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, first heard here on the station each Tuesday lunchtime at 1, again on Thursday evenings at 9 and Saturday tea time at 5. If you prefer a podcast, grab that each Friday from your podcast app of choice, or just ask your smartphone or smart speaker to play the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. Tech Talk, of course, it's our opportunity as blind and partially sighted people to come together and learn about the world of technology, what works, what should work, and what will probably never work. We're keen to hear from you, as always. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's our email address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Do send us your emails, voice notes, all that good stuff, and we look forward to hearing from you. Coming up this week, we take to the racetrack as Hubert finds out about one of the latest driving games to be made accessible. Callum Stoneman checks out the new check-in feature in iOS 17, and we'll be learning loads about Lodestone. I'm sorry. Welcome, Callum Stoneman. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How many jokes could you fit into that intro? How many puns?
I wouldn't dignify them by calling them jokes, quite honestly.
It's that was good.
Desperation. So how's things in your world this week?
Yeah, going pretty well. We've had some a bit of unfortunate news this week, though. Last week this came out about the company behind the Sunu Band. This is quite fresh as we're recording this, but they've put out a statement a couple of days ago saying that they've had to close down, unfortunately, due to manufacturing and financial issues, which is a shame.
Yeah,
the Sunu Band, for those who don't know, it was a mobility device that you wore around your wrist, and it used like a sonar system to detect obstacles that maybe your cane or your guide dog wouldn't necessarily pick up, similar to what's on the WeWalk, which, you know, I must admit, I said at the time, I'm not very impressed with. I thought the Sunu Band was doing quite well, but sadly we got that news from them recently.
There have been quite a few attempts, haven't there, at these sort of haptic feedback. You know, there was, of course, the what was originally called the back cane, and then I think it was called the ultra cane that had ultrasonic sensors and would provide haptic or little vibrations when you got near to an obstacle. I remember Baum at one stage had a product called Buzz Clip, which you wore around your neck like lanyard, and that would try to give you haptic feedback. I remember my wife at the time saying, well, it's buzzing, but now what do I do, right? Because, you know, it's not giving me any direction. There's a handheld device called Ray, I think, from an Austrian outfit, CareTech. That seemed to have quite good resolution. If you were walking along, you could find doorways. It was like a little torch, I suppose, an ultrasonic torch. But, of course, that then required the use of a hand, and your other hand might be busy with a cane or a guide dog. So I'm not surprised in some ways that Sunu Band is going away, because there have been a lot of attempts at this, and I'm not sure anyone's really quite nailed it yet.
No, I don't think they have. I'll tell you one thing that I remember, which I think I felt at the time was underrated, but maybe looking back, I wouldn't be as keen on it. But I used to have the RNIB eyeglasses back in the day. I don't know if anyone remembers these, but these were kind of sonar sensors. I think it was sonar. Maybe it was like ultrasonic sensors. I don't know if that's the same thing, but it was basically this sort of thing, a haptic feedback for obstacles, but in a pair of glasses. And I think part of the reason that they didn't do so well looking back was because they were huge. They were massive, like really thick glasses, and they looked very specialist, you know. And at the time when I had them, I was really young, so I don't think I really cared about how they looked. But they were, I liked them at the time. I don't know how I'd feel about them now, but they just seemed to disappear as well.
It's just as well this is not TV, because I do need something, because I've got a quite a significant bruise on my forehead at the moment. And this was thanks to a tree that was quietly minding its own business growing in the middle of a pavement. And it was one of those trees that sort of leant over a bit, you know, the type.
Oh, yeah.
And so your cane sort of swooshes underneath it and you don't pick it up. And then bang, your head definitely picks it up, right? I definitely need something that's going to pick those sort of, you know, those head height obstacles. Sometimes you get, you know, like the canopies in front of shops.
Yeah.
I mean, you're quite a tall guy, Callum. Do you find that head height obstacles can sometimes be an issue?
Yeah. My guide dog was quite good at detecting them and moving me around them, even though strictly speaking, she didn't have to because they were nowhere near her and her height. But since I've started using the cane, yeah, I'm getting a bump on the head all the time. I think my head's just become kind of solid now.
Well, there we are. Let us know, what do you use? Do you have any haptic mobility aids that you find to be useful? We'd love to hear about those. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Callum Stoneman, thank you very much. Stick around. It's another Tech Talk.
Good signal plus 25 CXP.
Left 4 long.
Signal score 8.3.
If you are into your gaming, you might have recently heard about the game Forza Motorsport being released. The game has some accessibility features to add to the current accessible gaming landscape, so it'll be interesting to talk about it, wouldn't it? Joining me is gamer Mr. Sightless Combat. How are you, sir?
Hello, I'm doing very well, thank you. I am Sightless Combat, accessible gaming officer for RNIB, as well as being an accessibility consultant and gamer without sights. And if you're not familiar with Forza, it's a track-based racing game as opposed to Horizon. So you've got Motorsport, which is the track racing version, and you've got Horizon, which is the open world set piece spectacle version, if you will. But Motorsport is very much the racing simulator or racing sim game of the two, but with a bunch of new features coming along in this latest release mere weeks ago now. The fact of the matter is that you've got gamers with no sight whatsoever, or even just, you know, varying degrees of vision, who may have struggled otherwise to play the game before, speeding around the tracks at ridiculous velocities and hopefully not crashing too many times into walls. So yeah, it's been a very, very interesting time to see the shift in discussion with the game being in people's hands now.
Yes, it's definitely been interesting based off the content that I've seen. So we've explained what Forza Motorsport is a bit, but let's talk more about the accessibility features of the game. What accessibility features have been added to the recent release?
Well, where do I start? I mean, the big ones, as a gamer without sight myself, having never had any sight whatsoever, menu narration is in with adjustable voice, volume and speed controls, which is amazing to see. Always good to be able to customize those things. There are filters for color blindness. There's ability to adjust various sort of text size for things like subtitles and things as well. But of course, there's a lot of audio things as well, including, I mean, the elephant in the room, arguably, blind driving assists, which are very, very cool. And of course, there's controller-related things as well to adjust your, you know, sensitivities and button mappings and things like that, as well as, of course, your whether your car is essentially driving itself or how much control you have over it as you try and negotiate all of those hairpin turns and, you know, ridiculous stopping distances between yourself and your rivals, for example. So there's a lot to look at, but blind driving assist, of course, is the big talking point of Forza Motorsport.
When it comes to blind drive assist, how does that all work?
So the blind driving assist feature, or I just shorthand it to BDA now, just for the sake of not saying too many words. BDA is a very interesting set of features, really. It's not just one thing. It's comprised of a few different auditory components. So you've got things like your racing guide, which is essentially an auditory version of the racing line that, you know, sighted people would be able to follow. But it's composed of your car's engine, which is actually a really interesting way of doing it. So you don't have your car in the center of your stereo field. You have it actually panning off to the left and right, depending on which way you need to turn. There's also things like deceleration cues indicating when you need to brake, There's your track limits, which determine, you know, where the edge of the track is in your sort of auditory field of vision, if you will. So, you know, if you hear a sort of increasing set of beeps to your left or right, and then it goes into a solid tone, then you've got to be aware that you are on the edge of the track on whichever side that's happening to. And then, of course, there's turn cues as well, where it will sort of count you down to an approaching turn with audio cues, not with verbal ones. But you'll also get, you know, pace notes from rally games, essentially. So, you know, left three into right hairpin or things like that. So, you know, with one being the most severe and six being the, you know, the least. So you can basically go through, you know, those six turns, if you will, with pretty much your foot on the throttle all the time, if you're being careful and driving well. Whereas you have to slow down for like the ones and the hairpins, but that all takes a lot of learning. There is, a pun intended, a learning curve to all of this, but BDA is a fairly robust set of features, and it's a very interesting thing to do, though it's not necessarily easy to master, but I'm sure we'll come on to that.
Before we come on to that, you've mentioned something also in your previous answer about how much control you've got over the car, whether it drives by itself or whether you drive it. What did you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is that as you're learning, you'll want to sort of figure out how things are meant to work in practice, but you have the ability to, you know, control how much your car is actually doing under your own terms, or whether the car is actually doing it a lot itself via, you know, AI functionality, as it were. So that being, you can have, say, the car steer itself on its own, and you're just controlling the throttle and the brakes and maybe the transmission if you're deciding to shift up and down yourself in terms of gears, or, you know, even if you're just using automatic. Whereas you can also invert that, and you can have, you know, you doing all the steering while the car is speeding up and slowing down of its own accord, which is absolutely terrifying when the car goes a lot faster than you think it will, and you're tearing through turns and you're thinking, oh my goodness, where am I going? So, you know, and you can customize that to quite a degree. So, you know, when I was first starting out, I was just steering in places, and then I sort of transitioned to using the throttle as well. And then I've, you know, done races where I've been using brakes completely under my own power, or sometimes where the brakes are partially controlled by the game itself. So there's a lot you can do with that as you learn, depending on how you want to play. And I know there's different members of the Forza community of, you know, blind drivers, to use the phrase in game, that, you know, are doing different various methods of learning and tutorializing as well. So every player is going to learn differently. I've showed a couple of people, and also on my first impressions video and my track recommendations video that I put together, car and track recommendations video, I've shown, you know, there's different ways to race things, and, you know, how I'm racing might look a little different to how other people are doing it. So there's a lot to look at there as well, that kind of goes hand in hand with the BDA feature set.
It definitely sounds like there's a lot of accessibility features there and a lot to kind of get your head around. And I mean, the BDA feature itself, when it comes to the blind drive assist, is there a tutorial in the game as to how to learn it? Because there's so many different audio cues that it will take some time to remember. And obviously you are also in a pressure environment during a race. So is there a way to learn blind drive assist effectively to be able to actually use it in the race itself and knowing how you're using it?
If you could have seen the massive grin on my face when you asked, is there a tutorial? Because that was one of the big points that I and others raised, you know, during the review period, you know, when those reviews first came along, and afterwards as well. Whereby, you know, people are being thrown into this high pressure environment where they're speeding around tracks at goodness knows how many miles an hour, and trying to also learn how this works in practice. Unfortunately, the game itself does not serve you a tutorial specifically for blind driving assist. The closest you can really get is going into free play and learning it firsthand, though there are community resources being put together. I know there's Discord servers that are you know, uniting drivers under a common cause of learning how this works and teaching and things. But there's also, you know, YouTube videos. I'm planning to put one together on the settings I'm using, because, you know, they're different to the default. And even slight changes to your controller settings can be a massive positive impact. And I may also try and do one showing off how blind driving assist work in what could loosely be described as slow motion. But the, you know, as it stands, there isn't an actual tutorial, you know, in the game itself, which is arguably where most players would probably learn best in terms of how this works, you know, as a game feature when they're playing. Because, you know, at least for me, that's how I learn well. You know, if I can repeat an action and have it be successful every time, you know, say, for instance, in God of War, I realized I could parry an enemy just because of the attacks coming in. I was thinking, I can parry you. So if this is 1, 2, 3 parries, and then I can retaliate, that's fine. You know, because that was a consistent action. And the same thing with this. If they, you know, if there was a tutorial on, say, how to take hairpins effectively in game, then I'd be like, okay, so I can take this hairpin and get a segment score of 5 or above out of 10. You know, that would be a great way to tutorialize it. So that might be a thing that, you know, maybe is added in the future with this game being a sort of long-term platform, as it were. But yeah, you know, people are going to have to kind of learn for themselves, find what resources work for them, and keep an eye out for, you know, YouTube videos, content creators, streamers, Discord servers, wherever they want to get their information to learn at present.
I mean, it's good to hear then that, you know, there are resources being worked on by the gaming community, because it does sound incredibly complicated with all these audio cues and so many different things to remember. It's great that it's there, but the whole learning aspect for any gamer is going to take some time to master it properly so you can take full advantage of it.
Yeah, and so that you can feel confident in what you're doing as well. Because, you know, if I get put on a new track, I'm thinking, okay, I'm not familiar with this track, I don't know how this car handles, but I'm still going to have to drive under these conditions anyway, you know, against AI that can essentially see regardless because of the way the AI works sometimes. You know, apparently, though, in all fairness, my own AI equivalent, or what they call a drivatar, has been giving other people problems. So I guess that's something in a positive sort of way. But, you know, when you're trying to drive tracks firsthand and you're unfamiliar with it and you just want to get through a race without coming off the track too many times, that can get really frustrating and it can be really intimidating. But what I would say is find a car and a track you like and practice that, get used to it, see how it feels. And then, you know, once you feel ready, which is, you know, going to be different for everybody else, you know, compared to me, for instance, or compared to each other, then, you know, go and transition to a different car. Try a different car on that same track. Try a different track with that original car. You know, there's all sorts of permutations you can use. And I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It took me a good while. And initially, I wasn't enamored at the prospect myself of this very steep learning curve. It didn't feel necessarily like it was fun initially to me, but the best thing I found as well was to play alongside friends. So you jump into a multiplayer lobby, which admittedly can be a little complicated at times because of, you know, people being on PC, people being on Xbox, but we'll come onto the platforms in just a moment. But, you know, jump in with friends, preferably if you're, you know, if you're of a similar skill level, that might be the best idea. So you're both learning as you go. You're both giving each other tips. I know, for instance, I've been racing with people and I've been yelling out lap times because none of us can hear the other players' laps as we go round. So I'm yelling, you know, 33.739 clean. And everyone's like, lucky. So it makes for some comedy as well. And it's very good fun. Once you get into the right headspace, I think is the best way to describe it, because it's a very different type of racing experience to what might have been seen, you know, decades ago with things like Top Speed, Mach 1, the audio games, you know, and others as well that I'm possibly forgetting. But those are the two big ones that stick in my mind from many years ago. So this is a totally different, you know, thing to do.
Now, if people would like to give this game a try, how can they get it? What platforms is it available on? What's the information there?
So it's available on Xbox Series X and S, on PC via Steam and the Windows Store, and also available, of course, on Xbox Game Pass as well, if you're on that service too, on any of those platforms that support it. The other thing to mention is it's also available as part of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate's cloud gaming, which has been very good fun, just loading the game up in a browser on a PC that's got good enough specs to run it, and you know, putting it through its paces in that respect. I haven't managed to do a full race on that as of yet, but I might do that as a fun video if people are curious to see just how well or not it runs under cloud, because of course running it in a browser is different to running it on, you know, a full set of hardware like an Xbox Series X. So, you know, which people might not want to do because they may not have it, they may not want to invest that much in a console. I've seen all sorts of discussions, but there's a few different places you can purchase it, or at least try it out should you have the facilities to do so.
It'd be quite interesting to see that game work in a web browser. I mean, yeah, okay. It'd be I'm not sure how well it would work in a browser, but yeah, if you want to give it a try, drop us an email and let us know. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk. I'd be very interested. If people want to follow you and check out some of your content or more videos regarding Forza Motorsport to get some tips and tricks, how can they go about that?
So you can find me on Twitch, Twitter, and on YouTube as Sightless Combat, SightlessKombat. And in various places there, you will find links to a Discord server that I run, which recently also helped organize an RNIB stream of Forza with, I think, about 9 of us, including myself, which was absolute carnage, chaos, and good fun in equal measure, as we had multiple drivers without sight or varying degrees of vision speeding around a track, including one honorary gamer without sight who stuck a blindfold on and had been practicing with BDA. So it was very, very interesting to do that. So you can find me Twitch, Twitter, YouTube as Sightless Combat. And of course, if you want to hear what RNIB is doing work-wise for gaming, and maybe even be a part of you know, future streams or suggest videos that you might want to see or anything like that, you can run it through gaming@rnib.org.uk. That is the email address, including, you know, receiving any information on RNIB's Design for Every Gamer or DFEG initiative, the rallying cry across the industry to raise awareness for the need for greater accessibility across the spectrum of sight loss, including, of course, for gamers without sight, like myself.
That all sounds very good, including that stream. Audio carnage sounds like the best type of fun, eh? There we go. Well, for now, Sightless Combat, thank you very much for coming on to talk to us about Forza Motorsport here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much. And to everyone listening, see you on track.
Last lap, 00 minutes, 33.739 seconds. Player Duke C, 1992, 0.0 second penalty for off track.
Left 4 long.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Apple's latest operating system, iOS 17, has recently been released about a month ago. And as you've probably heard on Tech Talk, we've been covering this and demoing some of the accessibility features. But I wanted to cover a few of the mainstream features as well that could be useful. And one of those that I've been playing with and finding quite useful is the check-in feature. And what this allows you to do is basically, it allows you to check in with a contact, basically, so you can send a check-in to somebody and they will get notified when you arrive at a certain location, and they can see your ETA as well, your estimated time of arrival, in the messages app. So a couple of things to bear in mind before you use this: both you and the recipient, the person you want to check in with, have to be running iOS 17 or later, and you both have to have iMessage enabled as well. So if for whatever reason one of you has iMessage disabled and you're using standard SMS, then this isn't going to work. And it's also not going to work if one of you is on an earlier version of iOS. And I assume it's obvious, but I'll say it anyway. This won't work if the recipient is on Android, because it is very much iOS and iMessage specific. So the way this works is that you go into the Messages app and there's a new section called check-in. So you go on there, and there's a couple of ways you can do it. You can either set a specific location and set how you're getting there. So for example, if you're driving or walking or taking public transport, and it will estimate how long it thinks it's going to take. You can customize that as well. So if it says it's going to take, I don't know, let's say 10 minutes, but you know that it's going to take you a bit longer, you can add an extra few minutes to that time. And then you click send and it will keep track of where you are. And it will keep track of certain conditions as well, such as traffic conditions. And it will automatically update that ETA based on your current route progress and also any traffic conditions. And then when you reach your destination, the recipient will get a notification to say, you know, in my case, Callum has arrived, and it will end the check-in. Equally, if it detects that you're going off route, or if it detects that you haven't made any progress for a few minutes, it will give you a prompt. And I'm not exactly sure what this prompt says, but it will basically give you a prompt on your phone and your Apple Watch, if you have one, to basically say, is everything okay? If you don't respond to that prompt, then it will send a notification to the check-in recipient to basically say, Callum has not made any progress, or is heading off route. And they will be able to see certain data. And you can customize how much they can see as well. So if you go into the first time that you use check-in, we're not going to see this now because I've used this previously. But the first time you use check-in, it will ask you how much data you want to share, whether you want to share limited or full data. Now, limited data, they only see this if you don't respond to that prompt, that basically says, are you okay? So if you don't respond and you've selected limited data, the recipient will see either your current location or your last known location if your phone's gone offline. They will see your phone's battery level. They will see your phone's signal strength. And if you've got an Apple Watch, they will see your Apple Watch's battery level and signal strength if you've got a cellular Apple Watch. If you select full, then they will see your phone's battery level and signal, as well as the route that you've travelled. So rather than just seeing your current or last known location, they will see your entire route from when you started the check-in. And they will also see when you last unlocked your iPhone. And again, if you've got an Apple Watch, they will see when you removed your watch from your wrist. So I guess what they're thinking there is that that kind of data, if you want to share it, so for example, being able to see when your watch was last removed, could give an indication of if something's happened, it could give an indication of what's gone on. They will also be sent that data if you use the emergency SOS feature as well. So even if it doesn't get to the stage where you've got that prompt and you don't respond, if you make an emergency SOS call, so an emergency services call, then the check-in recipient will immediately get all that data as well, depending on what you've selected. So that's the location way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to set a timer. So you could say, for example, set a check-in of an hour. And then I think the way this works, I haven't actually tried this, but I think the way this works is after an hour or so, your phone will prompt you and say, do you want to check in with whoever you've selected? And again, if you don't respond to that prompt, then that's when they will get either the limited or the full check-in data. And if you do respond, then the check-in will end and it will basically let the recipient know that everything's okay. I'm not entirely sure what the use case of the timed check-in is, the check-in timer, because that's not, from what I can see at least, that's not really location-based. I'm sure there is a use for it, because obviously Apple wouldn't have put it in there if there was no point to it. But I'm personally just not entirely sure what the use case is of that one. You know, obviously if it's useful to you, then fantastic. But personally, I've just used the location one. So that's the one that I'm going to demonstrate here. So the way that we get to this is we go into the Messages app. So I'm going to grab my iPhone and go into that now.
Messages. Messages. Jess. Website.
Okay, so I've gone into Messages and we're already in a conversation with my wife, Jess. So I'll just use her as her contact as a test for this. So what we're going to do, we're going to go to the bottom of the screen.
Dictate button.
And then we're going to flick to the left until we hear the apps button.
Message, iMessage, apps, button.
double tap on this.
Camera.
Now there's a list of apps here. So we're going to flick to the right.
Photos, stickers, audio, location.
Now this might catch you out because I was looking for ages under the location option for this, but it's not under location, so we'll keep going to the right.
More.
We're going to double tap on more.
Store. Hashtag images. Check-in.
Check-in. That's the one that we want, so I'll double tap on that.
Check-in. Button.
Now, what it's done, next to the message box, where you would normally enter a text message, it's put in the check-in there, and it will have given us a default setting, but we can double tap on that to change it. So if I go back to the bottom and then flick to the left until we hear the check-in option.
Send button. Remove app from message button.
We can remove it if we didn't mean to do that, but we'll carry on going to the left.
Check-in. Timer. Around 20. 40. Button.
Now that's interesting. So when I've been doing this out and about, it has defaulted to checking in when I get to my home address. But now, because I'm already at home, it's defaulted to the timer option. So that's interesting, but we can change it. So I'll double tap.
Cancel button. Check in heading. Done button. When I arrive button. One of two.
So I'm going to do this one. When I arrive. So I'll double tap.
Selected. When I arrive. One of two. After a timer button. Two of two.
And then that's the other option as well, after a timer. I've selected the when I arrive option, so I'll carry on going to the right.
Destination, heading. Select a location, button.
Double tap on this, select a location.
My location. Cancel, button.
And now we want to go to the search option.
Change, done, diamond, button. Search, search field. Search field is, search field is editing. Search, character mode, insertion point at start.
Now we're on the search field, so let's just type in, I know that there's a Costa coffee shop near us, so let's say we're meeting for coffee and I want her to know when I've got there, so I'll start typing in Costa.
Cap C S T A Costa Coffee, Cutica Way, Bolton, button.
That one will do. We're only testing this, so that's fine. That's fairly close to us, so I'll double tap on that.
Cancel button. Change location heading. Done button.
So then that's the location selected. We can verify that by going to the right.
Search. Search. Costa Coffee. Cutica Way. Bolton. BL5. 1FN. England.
Yep, that's the right one. So we'll click done.
Done. Button. Done. Cancel. Button.
And now there's one more step to this. The next step is telling it how we're getting there so that we can give it it can give her a more accurate ETA. So we'll go back to the right.
Check in, heading, done, button, selected, after a timer, button, destination, heading, Costa Coffee, Cutica Way, estimated travel time, heading, selected, driving, 10 minutes, button.
And then these are our options, so we've got driving, which it thinks it's going to be 10 minutes, that's probably about right.
Public transport, 25 minutes, button, walking, 45 minutes, button.
Yeah, it's close at driving, but not so much walking.
Add time, button, pop-up button.
So they're your three options. And now, this isn't like maps. It's not going to give you directions. And it's also, if you select, for example, public transport, it's not going to then ask you like which bus and train you're taking and what route you're taking. It's just basically picking up on the quickest route, I guess, and then putting that as your ETA. So that's where that add time button comes in, if you know that you're doing a different route. So just for the sake of testing it, let's go back to walking.
Walking, 45 minutes, button. Selected, walking, 45 minutes.
So that's set to walking, and then it's by default it's set to 45 minutes, but let's just say, for example, that I'm not setting off for another 15 minutes. So I'm going to go to that add time button.
Add time, button, pop-up button.
And double tap.
Add 15 minutes, button. Add 30 minutes, button. Add 1 hour, button. Dismiss context menu, button.
So you've got a few options there, 15, 30 minutes or 1 hour. So you could set this up a little bit in advance if you wanted to, and then you know that it's going before you set off. Or if it's not picked up on the right route, particularly for public transport, you can kind of personalise it and add your own times somewhat. I don't think there's a way to add a custom amount. So if you wanted to add, say, 45 minutes, I don't think you can do that. But we'll just go with 15.
Add 30 minutes, add 15 minutes, button. Add 15-minute public transport, 40 minutes, button.
So it's by default, it jumped the focus back to the public transport option for some reason, but that's fine. That's not what we've selected.
Selected. Walking. 1 hour. Button.
Now it's taken into account the extra 15 minutes that we put in there, so it says 1 hour.
Remove extra time. 15 minutes. Button.
You can take the extra time off if you want, but that's done now, so we're going to click on done.
Cancel. Check done. Button. Cancel. Back button.
And now if we go down to the bottom of the screen, it's just taken us back to the normal conversations view for Jess. So now if we go back to the bottom.
Send button. Remove app from message. Button. Check in. Cutic away. Around 20. 40. Button.
And there you go. That's set the check-in. So all we have to do now is click send.
Send button. Send back button.
And there you go. You heard the little vroom sound and that's sent that off to Jess. So she, in her messages app now, she is seeing, I don't think she's seeing my location, but she is seeing my that I'm heading to that Costa Coffee on Cutakeaway, which VoiceOver pronounces completely wrong. But it sees that, she can see that I'm heading to that Costa, and she can see that it's going to take, it's estimated to take me an hour. And that time will update as well, depending on how I'm doing. And again, I can, if it detects that I'm not going anywhere for quite a while, and I don't respond to that prompt, I've got this set to full data, so the couple of data options that I was talking about earlier. So if I don't respond, then she will see my network signal, my battery level of both my phone and my watch, because I've got an Apple Watch as well. She'll see the route that I've travelled so far. Basically, all the things that I mentioned earlier. Something that's a little bit odd, going back to these two data options, that's for the check-in feature overall. You can't set the level of data by contact. So for example, I might be pretty comfortable sharing full data with Jess if the worst happens, but I might not be comfortable sharing it with, say, somebody else. But it's either one or the other. You can change it whenever you want, but you can't change it per contact, and that's the way that I would have done it personally. But hey, you know, it's early days. Maybe that will change. So that's how you set up a check-in. And then just because I'm going to be doing this anyway, I'll show you how to cancel a check-in if you decide that you're no longer going to that place, or if you want to just end it manually, you can do that. So let's go down to the bottom.
Dictate button, message, iMessage, text field.
And you can carry on messaging as normal, by the way. So it doesn't affect, you know, it doesn't take over the whole conversation. You can still carry on sending and receiving messages to each other.
Apps button, check in, Cutic away, around 20, 45 button.
So you can see already, because I've not moved, it's changed it to 2045. So that's my check-in that I've just sent, so I can double tap on this.
Double tap to dismiss pop-up window button. Done button. Jess will be notified when you arrive. Cancel check-in button.
And there's the button there for cancel check-in, so if I double tap on this.
Alert. Cancel the check-in. If you cancel the check-in, Jess will not receive a notification when you arrive at Costa Coffee.
That's
cancel fine. Check-in button.
So we'll click cancel on that.
Button.
And there you go, that's ended the check-in now. And that's taken the notification off Jess as well to say that she'll no longer be notified. So there you go. That's a quick overview of how to use the check-in feature on iOS 17. If you found this useful, if you've been using this and you've found it useful, let us know. Get in touch and let us know your thoughts. techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Callum Stoneman there with a demonstration of the new check-in feature found in iOS 17. Callum, do you think you're going to be using this on an ongoing basis, or do you think it's just a sort of a curiosity for now?
No, I think I will use it. I mean, I'm quite terrible for, I always do that thing where if you're going somewhere and somebody says, oh, just, you know, let me know when you get there, drop me a text when you're there. And I always forget. So I think just for that purpose, you know, just making sure that people know when I've arrived. You know, quite a common one is if I'm traveling up to see family or if I'm traveling home and I'll be going from Bradford over to Manchester, which isn't a massively long journey, but it is a couple of trains. And, you know, and as I said, my family always say, oh, you know, let me know when you're back. So for them to be able to just keep track, make, you know that I'm doing all right, but then more importantly, just get that little alert when I've arrived home or arrived wherever I'm going. Yeah, I think it could be quite useful. I think you've got an interesting use for this, though, because you've got a teenager who I'm sure you like to keep track of.
Well, I have. Yeah, and to be fair, we do use Find My for that, so I can just pop onto the Find My app and, you know, see where he is or whatever. I mean, we should be clear. It tells me where his phone is. I mean, he's usually attached to his phone, but it is possible that if he became separated from his phone, then it does only tell you where the phone is, not necessarily the person. And maybe that goes without saying, but I think it's worth mansplaining. You know, he used to text me when he got to school, because he started walking to school when he was about 10 or 11. You know, and it's a relatively straightforward walk. There's only one busy main road, but it's a controlled, you know, accessible crossing. And he used to text me to let him know he'd landed. And he'd always write something silly or facetious or whatever, you know, about being getting to school, you know. And I quite like that. It always used to make me smile. So I hope we don't lose that. But I guess it is the modern equivalent to give me two rings when you get in.
Yeah, do you remember those days?
Yeah.
But then they'd always pick up.
Let us know if you're checking in with the check-in feature, or if you've got a better option for keeping track of your family and friends, not in a kind of a stalky way, but just having that, you know, reassurance that somebody did reach their destination. Callum, thanks a lot. We have received an email from Kelly, who writes to say, I've recently bought a talking time stat from Cobalt Systems. I wonder if you can help me. There are two cables and a probe on the gadget. One has a mains plug and one has a socket. I don't know what the mains plug does. Do you put it in the wall or what do you do with it? And there's also a probe. Where do I put that? Well, Kelly, we're not familiar with this particular product, but I had a little look on the Cobalt website, and it seems like the TimeStat has a built-in battery. So I think when you plug it in, it'll probably recharge the internal battery. And also, you can use it to control whether or not a connected appliance switches on or not. So you can use a heater, for example. So you could set up the TimeStat so that your electric heater or other device switches on at certain times of day or when the temperature gets below a certain level. I'm speculating slightly because I don't have one here to test. And then the probe, I guess it just takes the air temperature. I would check with the manufacturer. What do you reckon, Callum? Have you had a play with the talking TimeStat from Cobalt Systems?
No, unfortunately not. It's not something that I'm familiar with either. I think it's probably, probably the safest option is to just go back to Cobalt, see if they can give you a hand. Because, I mean, we could have a look and do our best, but we would be kind of speculating a little bit.
Yeah, it does say that the connected appliance can't exceed 2 kilowatts. It's only rated up to 2 kilowatts. So if you are using it to control whether or not your electric heater or other appliance switches on, make sure that it's not over 2 kilowatts. Kelly says there were audio instructions, but they weren't particularly helpful. That's frustrating.
Yeah, I think they'll be the best people to help you out, really. Just give Cobalt a call and see what they can do.
Anyway, Kelly seems to be enjoying the show and writes to us from West Sussex. So thank you, Kelly. Good to hear from you. Let us know how you get on with your TimeStat. So there's the TimeStat there from Cobalt Systems. Now, I've been using Hive for a couple of years, and I know you're getting Nest, Callum, and these are sort of smart thermostats that allow you to use Alexa or an app on your phone. What are you hoping it'll do for you when you get Nest?
Yeah, I'm finally getting into the 21st century, getting Nest installed tomorrow at the time of recording this. And I'm looking forward to it. The main thing that I'm hoping for is just that it will give me an accessible way to control the heating, because that's something that I've not had before. Like, we have got a really basic system at the minute. So we've got like a room thermostat, which just does the temperature. And it has got physical buttons. So, you know, you can press the temperature buttons up and down and they do a nice little click so you can feel them press. But I never know what temperature it currently is, what temperature it's set at. And then the timer, which is built into the boiler, that's, you know, setting the time on the boiler and then adjusting the timer is completely inaccessible. So I'm hoping just that it will give me an accessible way of managing all of that. And also, obviously, being able to control the heating remotely. But I think it's going to be great being able to just say to my smart speaker, you know, what temperature is it? Or turn the heating on, or turn the heating up by 2 degrees or whatever.
Mm.
Just more control and just being more energy efficient as well, you know.
Yeah. I think for me, the main use case that I like is when I'm out and if it's suddenly got a bit colder and I'm coming home, and if there's going to be nobody at home, you can put the heating on before you get in, so you come home to a nice warm house.
Yeah.
And that, to me, feels like a real tangible benefit of having a smart thermostat and heating system. And I've been using Hive, and that is pretty accessible. It's a little bit of a fiddle, you know, with the app to just set up all the timers for each day, when do you want it to come on, and so on. But it does integrate well with, the A Lady and the G Lady and all that, so you can control it with your voice from your smart speaker, and even on your watch, actually, if you've got an Apple Watch or similar.
Yeah.
You can do that as well. So let us know your experiences with controlling your heating systems. Have you got a smart thermostat like Hive or Nest or something else? We've also heard from Katie Simpkins at New College Worcester. Good to have your company, Katie. Thank you so much for writing in. And Katie says, I've been listening to RNIB Tech Talk and enjoy the show. Thank you very much. And Katie says, I'd like to learn more about the Lodestone GPS app. Katie says she's done a bit of a search, but didn't find much info about it. Well, Katie, especially for you, our very own Hubert Pavalkovich has an interview about the very same Lodestone GPS. Here's Hubert.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and recently we have had an email from a listener asking about Lodestone GPS and whether any of us have used it or what it is. And we thought the best way to go about this is to go straight to the source. So joining me now is Lodestone GPS developer Sean Kirkpatrick to tell us more. Sean, hello.
Hello.
Sean, it's great to have you. And if we could start with a bit of a history of Lodestone GPS. How did the idea come about and what it is?
All right. Lodestone GPS is an accessible GPS application for mainly blind pedestrians, but it will also work if you're traveling in a vehicle. But it came about, I guess the main idea started actually in 2004. You know, a friend of mine wanted to build a GPS app for, well, at the time, the talking cell phone was quite new. So we decided to build on the Nokia platform. And it was kind of the early days, of course. You had the phone and then a separate GPS receiver and various other bits and pieces. And so I built the app. And then in 2006, we launched it to the public as an open source project. And so that went kind of worldwide. And at that point, it was a free program. So we had a lot of users and actually a lot of users in Europe and various other countries. And that lasted until, 2010, 2012 or so, when Microsoft bought over Nokia and kind of killed the ability for us developers to, well, operate correctly. So that version of the program kind of died. And in about 2015 or so, I decided to port the Lodestone over to iOS, because obviously the iPhone had become big by then. And so it was a completely new interface, and in my opinion, now that I'm used to it, much better. And in 2017, that version of the program launched, and that's what we've had since. It's been in the App Store since July 2017.
So how does the app work on the iPhone? What functions have you got available in the app?
Okay, it's a text-based app only, so there's none of the graphics. It's meant for people using VoiceOver. I should probably mention that I'm actually totally blind, so if it's at least we know at least one person has used the thing with VoiceOver. I know that much. But the functions, you can explore your neighborhood, you can get your points, it has a route planner, you can it has a trip meter. There's a lot of other functions in that program. It tries to be like the Swiss Army knife of GPS programs.
And when it comes to maps and data and locations, where does it get that information from?
It gets it from a system we call PointShare, which is basically a mirror of OpenStreetMap. So the PointShare system has actually downloaded all the data from OpenStreetMap, and it's also combined with other sources, such as public mapping data for other cities and for transit stops. And it can also combine with points that other users may share. So users can enter in their own points and then upload them to PointShare so that other people can benefit from them as well.
And can users create their own points and keep them private to themselves as well? What's the privacy like in the app?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can keep them privacy. Nothing uploads without permission. It will. You only upload, actually, if you want to. One of the main things of Lodestone is it actually tries, whenever possible, not to use data. Because, well, for the longest time, I never had a data plan. So, and they're quite expensive in Canada. So it was one of the main selling points for Lodestone was it didn't use data, but it does now for a couple of its features, like the route planner, for example, requires a data connection, but it only requires it as it's doing them. Like once it does the plan, once you have the data loaded, you can basically go off and it doesn't require any more data. So it's very good that way.
So just to clarify, is mobile data required for you to navigate yourself around a specific route, or is data required for navigation?
No. Once you've got the route planned in, you can basically, you don't have to have your data connection running anymore. So yeah, once you have your mapping data loaded, let's say, it's not like some programs where it's having to continuously download pieces. It's like you download the map data for a region and it will stay continuous until you re-download again.
So when it comes to storing the data, how big is it? How much storage is required for the app to use?
It will all depend on the amount of data you try to download. It would, realistically, it's probably, I don't know, it might be a couple hundred megs realistically, for, because if you, let's say, download the data for a city that you like, that you want to use or something. Some people have actually tried to download data for whole countries or whole regions and found that it doesn't really work all that well because the data required is just too much. That's the thing now. Back in the day when Lodestone was started, we had almost no data to work with. But now with things like OpenStreetMap, we're actually drowning in information and it's sometimes a bit too much. But there's no way, for example, that you could, let's say, store the whole world on Lodestone because, well, on the PointShare server, it's actually a 4 terabyte database, so it can be rather large.
When it comes to navigation apps, it's quite a competitive industry. There are a lot of navigation apps for blind and partially sighted people. What makes Lodestone GPS different? What would you say makes it stand out?
Well, I would say, first of all, price, because at the moment it's $15 Canadian in the App Store, so whatever that translates into in everyone else's local currency. And the fact that it's actually been designed and developed by blind people. Like, as I said before, I'm actually totally blind. And all of our beta testers are also visually impaired to some degree. So it's basically been tested. So you know it's going to be accessibility. If it didn't work for us, it just wouldn't work. And the fact that it is only text-based, so it's not trying to do graphical mapping and things. And I think we've tried to make it as intuitive, at least I think so, as possible for people to use.
So if people would like to find out more information before downloading the app, where can people go to find it and what sort of information can they get, for example, from your website or any other portals?
You can go to www.lodestone-gps.com, and on there's the complete user manual that you can read online. And there's also various tutorial videos that we've tried to do, and tutorial texts as well. So some of the videos have been translated to text and just other textual tutorials. So you can read up. Basically, you don't have to actually buy the program to look at all the information about it. And on there, there's a lot more information. I think there's more of an about page and all of that other stuff that you would expect to know.
Excellent. And if people wished to contact you to give some feedback on the app or ask further questions, how can they do that?
In the program itself, there's a help section, and then there is actually a feedback section in there. You can actually report a problem or just give general feedback for suggestions or comments or whatever. And people do sometimes. More often, people might report problems, but you know they do give feedback as well.
Is an account required in order to use it?
Yes, if a little account, an account is required to register for point share only, so that if you're uploading points, your points are your own. But basically, so it basically it asks for an email address, but it could be anything really. It doesn't actually use this for any sort of communication or anything. There's no, yeah. So if you give it a username, it's not actually used for anything that you would find privacy invading. It is just mainly for the account purpose.
Fantastic. Well, Sean Kirkpatrick, a developer of Lodestone GPS, thank you very much for coming on and telling us about your app here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Here we are at the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. We do appreciate it. We also welcome your comments, questions, feedback, all that good stuff. TechTalk@rnib.org.uk, TechTalk at rnib.org.uk is how you get in touch. Why not press record in your voice memos app and send us a voice note? We'd love to hear from you. And if you like what you hear and you enjoy the show, then do tell a friend, spread the word, and we look forward to being with you again next week. But that's it for now. From myself, Dave Williams, and Callum Stoneman.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.